There are always things you are too young or too old for. I wish I saw The Clash or David Bowie in their prime. The mid-2000s pop punk bands like Sum 41 seemed cool, but I was probably too old for it. I find myself listening to Olivia Rodrigo, and I don't know if that's sad or not, but man, it would be so great if I was young for that. But there are things that, through the timing of my birth, I totally nailed the timing for. That insane comic book boom of the early 90s, the release of that last Harry Potter book, and so many things about music. One that still stands out clearly in my mind is Recovery. Recovery was a TV show on the ABC that, in retrospect, only lasted a very short time. But its impact was huge, especially what it meant for local and up-and-coming bands. And it was a show for teenagers in Australia, who I just happened to be. Welcome to Just Ace, a podcast about the 90s Australian alternative music scene, whatever the hell that means. This week, we look at the groundbreaking TV show Recovery and the battle to be authentic on TV.
Guten Morgen, and welcome to Recovery.
Seeing music performed live on TV is important, especially for bands. I believe this with all my heart. It's not enough to see a bright, shiny film clip of Cher enjoying a leisurely boat cruise. Bands being these groups that make their own music, you want to see who they are, and which one's the drummer, and maybe even how well they can play. Then there's just the fun of seeing what a band is wearing, what colour guitars they use, if anyone in the band is particularly hot, or if anyone in the band looked particularly weird. Seeing a band play live on TV is also, implicitly, an ad for going to see them live at a show. So it's extra important for bands who make money from touring. For the people who love it, you go deeper. Oh look, the bass player from Snout is also the singer? That's different. The bass player from The Living End's instrument is the size of another human? That's different. The bass player from Tism seems to be lost in a sea of 50 other people all wearing balaclavas? That's different. People, I have to believe, like watching talented people sing and play music. I've worked on many artist showcases in my life. You invite a lot of press and industry types to some small bar to see an up-and-coming artist perform. I would openly joke that those nights, the marketing is just watching this new artist sing. That's the sell. The ABC in Australia was always pretty good with live TV performances. And the show that pioneered it all was Countdown, hosted by Molly Meldrum. It was a music show where bands were interviewed and they had a chance to perform. Huge international acts and lots of Australian ones were broadcast to everyone in the country on Sunday nights. It was one of the most important TV shows in Australian music history. When it started in 1974, 1 year before Double J, it was incredibly countercultural. The mission was to bring young people to the ABC, and the show's creators rightly identified pop music as the thing to bring in the kids. There's been so much said about Countdown. There's documentaries, compilations, and even a biopic of the host, Molly. I'm not going to rehash all that. Because when I was a teenager, in the 90s, Countdown was long gone. It ended in 1987. I knew none of why it was important. Molly had moved over to Hey Hey It's Saturday, the Channel 9 primetime variety show. Countdown, for me, was mainly shown in the late hours during the music film clip show Rage. I would get annoyed because instead of playing more new clips, they played clips from some old show with old artists I didn't care about. It was hard to understand the fuss about Countdown as a teenager because it was what daggy old people liked. I, of course, learned to appreciate what the show did many years later. But there was one other thing that used to irk me about Countdown clips when they came on Rage, and that's how everyone lip-synced. Why is it so hard to get actually live music performances on TV? Entertainment shows love having the star power of musicians as their guests, but playing live was always different from having a guest talk. It was much easier to just sit them at a panel of your talk show and have them tell you about their new album. You could commit to it though. You could build a place on your set, like the American talk shows do, where bands perform regularly. And here's the thing. It's 3 to 5 minutes every night where it's unscripted and anything can happen. Producers don't like that, which is why so much music television is mimed and lip-synced. It's not because people can't sing, it's because they are afraid someone will swear, or hit a really bum note, and what if they play too fast and there's dead air, or if they play too slow and they can't cut away to the news on time? There are many famous stories of bands booked on live TV shows who didn't do what they were told. So it's just a risk. A lot of shows, like those US talk shows, are all pre-recorded earlier anyway. Because to do live performances on TV, that's insanity. But that was one of the starting places for the ABC TV show, Recovery. Here's Elvis Costello and the Attractions on SNL in 1977, where they performed live but changed songs after a few moments. It got them banned from the show.
I'm sorry, ladies and gentlemen, there's no reason to do this song here. Radio, radio. One, two,
three. There were some important steps between Countdown and Recovery. One was called The Factory, which started in 1987, just a couple of months after Countdown ended on the ABC. But instead of Sunday nights, this show would air for 3 hours on a Saturday morning. The Factory was hosted by Andrew Dado and Alex Papps. Alex Papps was in The Henderson Kids and later Home and Away. Andrew Dado was just starting a long career as a host of things. The show had music and sketches and played clips. It had performances by Crowded House and interviews with Kylie. They would get new bands too. In indie rock circles, The Factory was the Australian TV show that captured the only TV performance by Melbourne band God in 1988. They were signed to Agogo and they were just teenagers when they released a song called My Pal. It is surely one of the top 5 songs ever written in Australia. Without The Factory, we wouldn't have this important record of this band in arguably their prime, because it's so friggin' awesome. Here's My Pal by God live on The Factory. Except it wasn't live, it was lip-synced. The Factory didn't last, in part due to the music and youth segments moving to a new show that would be squarely seen as the follow-up to Countdown. That was called Countdown Revolution. They put the word revolution in there to sound cool, I guess. Revolution has become a meaningless term. I saw a hairdryer recently that sported the tagline about joining the revolution. But in this instance, there would be a revolution. I'm not sure it was what they had in mind when they named the show. Countdown Revolution was supposed to continue the Countdown brand for a new generation. It launched in 1989, 2 years after Countdown finished. It aired weeknights at 6:30 p.m. It was the show that was up against the nightly news on the commercial networks. If anything, it was ABC's cheap can of programming for a bad time slot. The show didn't rate, so they tried to inject it with some new energy and new hosts after just a few months. They chose comedian Tanya Lacey, who was a segment host on The Factory, and Mark Little, who would really be best known as Joe Mangle from Neighbours. The show became more fun and chaotic with these two funny hosts. It was filmed at a nightclub with an audience. There was a feel that anything could happen. But that wasn't the reality. The reality was a lot of it was pre-recorded. They used fake audience applause and crowd noise, and the bands lip-synced to pre-recorded tracks. The new hosts and many of the crew hated how this worked. So did many of the bands, and part of it was just the attitude of the generation coming through. Authenticity was in. It was building up in the indie scene and it would soon break with Nirvana. On the 20th of June 1990, the hosts of Countdown Revolution staged an on-air protest live. They ripped up the run sheet on air and handed out signs to the crowd, and the signs read, TV is a lie and TV is lip service. Their demand was for the show to be more authentic and not to be told what to say and for bands to play live. Host Mark Little couldn't help but mock the word revolution That was in their show's name.
A hallmark day in the history of Australian TV.
Yes! Please, everyone!
Revolutionaries! Revolutionaries! When the head of ABC Light Entertainment said to me, we want this show, Countdown Revolution, to be anarchy, I said, I beg your pardon. Have you looked that up in the dictionary, sir? Do you know what anarchy means? He went, yes. Yes. I went, I don't know. I've got my doubts. I've really got my doubts.
Tonight, we are doing something never before attempted in Australian television. People, we're asking you to back us. And we're asking you to back us. And if you don't think you're going to back us, leave now.
So this is going to be a long half hour.
We mean it. If you're not going to back us, leave now.
The time for talking is over, revolutionaries. It's hard, it's confusing. It's confusing to most of Australia. The time for talking is over. We are now going to act. We have certain demands, revolutionaries. Tonight, this is the rundown of the show as it usually stands. You're not even going to get a glimpse.
You're not going to see it. You know why?
Because the protest has begun.
Please.
The revolution is here.
If you would
we like to. Are now officially on strike.
For those keeping track, this on-air protest was 1 month after the Fuck the Police controversy at Triple J that led to the staff walking out and playing NWA's Express Yourself on repeat that I covered in episode 1. During the protest show, Tanya Lacey gets the crowd to chant Express Yourself over and over. It's also a little over 2 months before the big Triple J protest at Sydney's Town Hall, which was also in episode 1, and the walkout of the entire staff of Sydney Street Press on the street, which I covered in episode 7. Maybe it was just the fact that it was a new decade, but revolution wasn't just a word on a TV show or a hairdryer. What happened in the end was that the presenters were fired. They were told so by fax. There was no other way, really. They were replaced by Lockie Daddo, younger brother of the factory's Andrew Daddo. Andrew and his old factory co-host Alex Papps would also fill in. But the show only lasted a few more months, and it was cancelled itself before 1990 was over. So it had been a few years since the ABC had a flagship music show by the time recovery began in 1996. By that time, grunge and Britpop and Australian alternative, whatever the hell that means, had come along. The authenticity that the Countdown Revolution team craved was natural for the people who worked on recovery. Those people included creators Paul Clark and Bruce Kane. Both men were experienced producers and older than the hosts and the young bands that they would champion on their show. They realised that the time was right for a show aimed at kids without hiding any of the artifice of TV. Bands could play live. You could show camera operators and the area behind the sets. It didn't matter, as long as it was fun and honest. On paper, it looked like Recovery could be any other music TV kids show. It had the same morning time slot as The Factory. There was a host, a bunch of presenters who did segments, interviews, live performances, sketches, music videos, a studio audience. The format itself wasn't that special. It's all about what they did with it. The first photos of the Recovery cast saw a bunch of fresh faces. This wasn't a show hosted by the bad boy from the Henderson Kids and the latest Daddo that they found. None of them had any real TV experience. They also look so 90s. Everyone is thin and wearing tight t-shirts. They had trashy sneakers, short spiked hair, hair clips and piercings. For a teenager like me, they looked incredibly cool. And they kinda looked like us. The head of this group was Dylan Lewis. He was tall, lanky, had an eyebrow ring, and his hair colour could change as easily as you change a four-colour pen. He was our host. Dylan had no experience on TV. Instead, he played in a band. When I was 16, this was the most commonly used trivia tidbit in the schoolyard. Did you know Dylan Lewis is in a band called Brown Hornet? I never heard Brown Hornet back in the day, and in fact, I only realised I should look them up when researching this podcast. If you ever wondered what they sound like, they were kind of funky with a horn section and slapping bass. Here's Brown Hornet with Love. It was live TV, so Dylan just did whatever. Doing perfect takes were out of the question, so he and the show embraced the chaos. Dylan tripped over his own words. CDs would be held upside down. He would look into the wrong camera. He would lose his notes and just make things up. But look, it was all fun, right? Dylan wasn't like an older brother authority figure telling us how you should be. His persona wasn't that he was smarter than us. He didn't name drop obscure indie influencers or talk above us about music criticism. He wasn't a snob. He was one of the kids, just fully grown. He was basically a cartoon man as conjured by indie teenage Australia. And he had energy and charisma. Let's face it, if he was a young man, today he'd be a pretty good YouTuber. He has that way of instantly reacting and his mind goes at high speed. For teenagers sugared up on cereal, he was just right.
These weird faces here, it's nice to see.
Weird faces.
Just heard Black Bugs off Unit, the brand new album, and you're calling the tour Unit Shifting Tour as well.
Yeah.
This unit word, this is a bit of an industry term, isn't it? What does it mean?
That's right, it means CD.
It means CD, not Frisbee.
No, it doesn't mean Frisbee.
Oh, okay. What do you mean? Why are you using this industry term?
I don't know, it's kind of like the computer word as well, like video unit.
Data kind of stuff.
Yeah, kind of robotic.
So who was the album for?
But he wasn't the only one. Although Dylan was the host, the other presenters were just as important. It wasn't a one-person show. It was a gang. And every Saturday morning, I could catch up with the gang. Dylan's first co-host was Tamara Roos, but she left when the show left Sydney early on. It moved to Melbourne into the same studio where Countdown was filmed. Jane Gazzo became the second most visible presenter from the show, eventually feeling like the co-host. Like Dylan, she just didn't look like anyone else on television, but she looked a lot like some of the girls I went to school with. I'm not sure who started it first, if Jane was just dressing like her friends, who were probably dressing like older versions of my friends, or if we all dressed like that because of recovery. Jane seemed to give more straightforward information dumps. She would often be the so-called straight man to Dylan's wildness. Maybe that came from the fact that she had some presenting experience, having been a presenter on Melbourne's Triple R in her teens.
So much, Sonic Youth, for coming and coming on our show. It's a great honour. Thurston, Lee and Kim, give them another round of applause. Where to start? We've actually seen you on this show before, Thurston. We actually played some stuff from High Octane. Do you remember that show, Thurston's Alley? We love that. Is that show still going?
That's a pretty good show. It was done by Sofia Coppola.
She also played in bands and sang. In fact, in the height of her recovery fame, she was the voice of a single called I Want More, which was a cover of a Can song by Glenn and Vincent from the Underground Lovers. They were called GBVG, and the singer was credited as Mitsuame. Here's Mitsuame and GBVG with Can's I Want More from 1998. Jane wasn't the only one who was more reliable than Dylan. There was also Lee Winnell. Lee was the film guy. He also dressed like one of us, with band tees and jeans. He was the smart one, our mate who knew stuff. We all loved that mate of ours who was really smart at something. And Lee, what he knew was film. He didn't have the quirkiness of Dylan or the allure of Jane. His hair colour stayed disappointingly normal throughout the series. Another bit of trivia that gets mentioned often is that Lee ultimately created the Saw series of horror films and became a successful horror filmmaker. I wonder if it was possible to get through an original Australian screening of the first Saw movie without someone saying, "Hey, is that the guy from Recovery?" And then there's the Enforcer. The Enforcer was a large man whose face was completely hidden underneath a hood and sunglasses. He wore a black shirt that had the word Enforcer written on it. He never spoke, he just sort of wandered around the set, at times helping out and at times getting in the way. He was so distinctive and weird that he soon became part of the marketing and as much a symbol of the show as Dylan. The Enforcer would turn out to be Angus Sampson, who would carve out a fine career as an actor. The idea around the Recovery set was kind of like a share house. There was a conceit in the beginning that all the presenters lived in this house. But it wasn't a real share house, of course. It was the cartoon version of one. It was colourful and mismatched and messy. There were kitchens and living rooms. There were shoes, telephones, mugs and junk just left around. But this wasn't Wayne's World, which looked like someone in their 20s bedroom. This was the cartoon of what a 16-year-old thought a share house was. The brightness and colour and madness was turned up. It looked like the Accidentally Kelly Street film clip. The so-called house part of the studio was where the interviews and segments took place. Bands and guests would sit on the sofa or the kitchen table or the swings or wherever. Behind them, there'd be people walking around, making cups of tea, and just sort of being around. One whole side of the share house was the studio audience. Every Saturday morning, it was full of kids. Like any TV show, you just applied to be in the audience. As it was mainly filmed in Melbourne, I could never go. I was amazed there were kids there at all. How could they get there at 9 in the morning? Was there a bus? Were their parents driving them? And did you just have to sit there the whole time? Actually, the thing is, you didn't always need to sit there. It seemed like once a week there'd be a chance to rush the stage or get up and dance, or some segment where the crowd could participate or someone would walk into the crowd. Like someone helping with a phone in or having a go at a jumping castle. They showed the crowd a lot and people started to bring signs with secret messages for their friends. If you've not noticed it, a lot of talk shows never show the audience. But I like that Recovery showed their fans. And then there were two spaces for music. One was for the house band. And like The Enforcer, it was one of those ideas that was pure Recovery. And one of those ideas that would never happen on The Factory or Countdown Revolution. Every week a band would be the house band. Their job was to provide the musical interludes for the morning. The little stings between segments. They'd be there all morning in the corner, running through a dozen or so riffs as needed between segments. Usually the band were unsigned and unknowns. Notably, Silverchair agreed to be the house band once, as did The Wiggles. I'm glad the producers gave those upstarts a go. I was in a high school band at the time of all this. If you had to ask me our ambitions, number one and two would have been to host Rage and play the big day out. Probably somewhere around 6 or 7 would be becoming the Recovery house band. Not being on Recovery itself, or, for that matter, making emotionally resonant music that moves people. That was all secondary to working out which classic riffs we would do on Recovery as the house band and the order in which we would do them.
It's Caustic Soda! That's our house band for today. There's their little vinyl-y thing that they've got out, and there's an album that they've got, their second one. It's called Music from the Motion Picture, of which I don't think there is one. But they're a house band, so keep watching, and it'll happen before your eyes all this morning.
The other part of the set was where bands played, and this was the coolest and most memorable part of the show. The sets for band performances were unlike any other music performance show ever. Take it from someone who has watched tens of thousands of TV music performances on YouTube. Every band played on their own backdrop. They were made just for the show and just for the band. The backdrops usually reflected the band's current album artwork or tour artwork. It was like the bands were playing on their album covers come to life. Spiderbait performed in front of giant versions of the cartoons of their album covers. The big anime face on the cover of Ivy and the Big Apples was as big as the band members themselves. UMI played it in front of a big version of their colourful album cover for Number 4 Record. Regurgitator, of course, played in front of a large silver backdrop with a big yellow circle. Bands had taken all the effort to choose great album covers to reflect their music, so why not use it and remix it as the perfect visual? And why doesn't every TV show around the world do this? It's so simple, and every band loved it. And it wasn't just for the big bands either. In Recovery's classic period, they did it for every band. Even if it was just a cool set with the band's name on it in some fun-looking style. You get a custom backdrop just for you. Whether you were a massive international band like Sonic Youth, or an up-and-comer on your first EP like Cordrazine, you were treated the same. And of course, everyone played live. And it wasn't just one song and done. You were there for the morning and you could do a few songs. Your latest single, maybe an album track, or a B-side, or even a cover. People could see different sides of the bands over the course of a show. There was a lot of fun and anarchy on the set of Recovery, but respect for bands and music was sacred. On the other hand, all those people who worried things would go wrong if you don't pre-record bands just needed to look at Recovery to prove them right. Because a lot of things did go wrong. Thing was, it turned out okay. There are some famous instances of bands going off the rails. If you've never seen them, I'll link to a few blog posts of the best ever Recovery performances. But I'll talk about a couple. And let's start with the John Spencer Blues Explosion. I remember watching this live on TV as a kid. In my teenage mind and my adult memory, they set fire to the entire studio, and John Spencer grew to the size of Godzilla, and emergency services had to be called. Watching the YouTube clip back today, I was all ready for it to be tame compared to how I saw it in my memory. It's actually still pretty wild. At school, many of us used the motto, "The blues are number one," for several weeks. We just say it for no reason. Even now, when someone mentions the blues, I feel like saying, "The blues are number one." I also saw the Green Day incident live. I didn't realise at the time that swearing was one of the few no-nos on Recovery. It was still a morning kids show after all. But Green Day were sitting down for an interview, but then decide to go over to the house band, take over their instruments, and do a song. And the song they did was The Grouch. It was a great song, but it was full of swearing. Apparently, people got in trouble.
Well, so I read your gifts.
No.
Yeah!
You can't have impromptu.
You can't just do that. Do you mind? I can't do that.
We've got a tour going on.
Come on, it's live!
All right, what should we play? What do you want to hear?
Platypus!
Solo!
I was a young boy that had big plans. Now I'm just another shitty old man. Well, I had fun and I hate everything. Well, I deserve a few.
Those are very obvious examples. But with the great sets and the fun audience, I feel like bands started to bring it, and the chaos became kind of expected. And this was certainly true around 98. Bands knew that Recovery was a stage for a performance, more than just a chance to sing a song. TISM, of course, made the most out of it. They took over the entire floor with the audience all doing aerobics like they did in the film clip of the song that they performed, What Are Ya? They also had jumping castles for the crowd to play in. Midnight Oil invited the audience to write messages on some blank walls while they played. Happy Land, a side project for Kwan from Regurgitator and Janet from Spiderbait, played in animal outfits. Underground Lovers brought hula hoop dancers. Screamfeeder just had some bloke dance while they played. It was all fun. And there was fun on the sofa too. Dylan had plenty of memorable interviews. In the early years, there was awkwardness as the show and Dylan found their feet. But pretty quickly, everyone realised that this was not a formal interview like you do on other shows. I also liked the fact that they often interviewed several members and it was not just the same lead singer every time. Everyone was a friend. Everyone was welcome to join the chat. Friends of Rom famously came on and attacked Dylan. They had all four members, so they outnumbered him very easily. They tried to shave his head, but they shaved his leg instead. It was live. It was Friends of Rom. What did you expect? Other shows wouldn't let one Friends of Rom on, let alone all four of them. And there are huge stars that visited the show from around the world. Sonic Youth, Public Enemy, Pulp, and many others. Kylie Minogue spent a morning with Dylan sitting in a park talking about music. But it wasn't about the internationals. I don't think the biggest stars cared to wake up that early for a show. It was the Australian bands that made the effort. They knew it was important. The biggest and best bands from the era would come in and they would do multiple appearances and maybe even a couple of times a year. I guess just whenever they got to Melbourne, they did Recovery. UMI, Regurgitator, Spiderbait, Grinspoon, Living End, Jebediah, and many more appeared more than once. Like The Factory did with the band God, they also captured a lot of bands on possibly their only TV appearance. The Locksmiths didn't really do a lot of TV. Bands like Finny Skag, Cordrazine, The Earthmen, Skunk Hour. Their careers didn't last. But even if they did, we got them now in their prime. And here they are, singing and playing their best songs. Recovery managed to capture it. If only the show started earlier to capture the bands who just missed out, like The Clouds and The Meanings. Beyond the occasional chaotic moment, there was lots to learn, because the show wasn't 3 hours of people being set on fire. The meat of the show was the news, like the all-age gig guide or the film reviews or who was touring and who had new music out. For a national show, it felt surprisingly local. They would always mention where bands were playing, no matter how regional they were going. It wasn't just about the big cities. And it was matched with the pre-recorded segments that featured interviews from people from all walks of life, from anywhere in the country. I really can't stress enough how anti-celebrity this all was. Lee Whannell would later say that it was so different from MTV, and he was right. MTV were stars who gave you glimpses into elegant parties and backstage and the glitz and glamour. Recovery, Australia's biggest bands, just seemed like friends who wandered into your share house. There were a couple of times Recovery had a guest host. I guess Dylan had to have days off every now and again. It was odd turning into Recovery with no Dylan. Instead, there was Coxie from The Foes, or Dave McCormack from Custard. McCormack had the bad luck of being a guest host when Friends of Ron were on a second time. They attacked him with actual custard. I think it says a lot about McCormack and Coxie that they were both charismatic enough to hold a whole TV show, and that they were willing to do it, because I assumed that, in part, it looked fun.
Look, I should reintroduce myself, because I'm Andrew from The Foves, and we're the house band, and we're also, you might have got up late and just not know who the hell we are. We're the house band, we're also hosting, so we're having a great time, hope you are. And it's
I didn't realise how much recovery changed over the years. I was just too young to realise it as a kid, but the show technically ran from 1996 to 2000. It was really the years of 97 and 98 that were the most memorable. The show got so big that there was spin-offs. There was recovery CDs, featuring music of the TV performances. They sold enough that they did two volumes of double CDs. What's great is that they had big bands, but not the obvious single. Usually, it was a cool album track. They had the odd special. Like UMI, Neil Finn, Spiderbait, and even Metallica did special small sets in the recovery studio. There was also a magazine, published by the people who did Juice magazine, that ran for 25 issues. Angus Sampson was an editor. John Howard became Australia's Prime Minister in 1996. During the election, Howard promised that there would be no cuts to the ABC budget. 4 months after, in early 1997, he announced the ABC budget would be cut by 2%. Recovery existed on a knife's edge in 1998, and by 1999, they had to make cuts or just give up. They made the hard decision to move out of the studio where they filmed Countdown. They did shows from an actual house, but by then Jane had left for the UK. Live performances and the house band were all gone. Angus Sampson took off the enforcer mask and became a presenter. Lee took over as host, along with Janelle De Silva. It was Recovery by name, but the show was very different. The live performances moved to a new show on the ABC called The 10:30 Slot. It was on at 10:30 or close enough after the late news. It was hosted by Dylan Lewis and Angus Sampson without the enforcer mask. Gone was the chaos, and it felt like a regular late-night talk show. The lineups were incredible. They managed to get big bands like Foo Fighters and Muse. They kept the ethos from Recovery of highlighting local bands like Jebediah and the odd up-and-comers like Girling. But at least the show was live, and they didn't lip-sync. My Dear UMI appeared on the same episode as a band I love called Fountains of Wayne. During UMI's performance, Tim took the mic off the mic stand, which ultimately broke, and he couldn't put it back. So he put it in his shirt pocket and sang into that. It would have been weird and chaotic on a Saturday morning, with a crowd of teenagers cheering him on. But on a big stage with a quiet audience on a Friday night, it was just weird. But I enjoyed the 10:30 slot. I saw a lot of bands I loved on that show. But it didn't stick in the memory like Recovery. There was not enough character around the rest of the show, and nothing made it distinctive. Then, at the end of one episode in 2000, Dylan announced they would take a break for a few weeks, and then the show just never came back. I don't remember those final years of Recovery at all. If you asked me, I thought they cancelled Recovery and then 10:30 slot started. I must have grown too old to be up at Saturday mornings. I didn't even bother to tape it. But I do remember those 96, 97, 98 shows. I was 15 to 17, probably at the top end of the right age. This was probably awesome too if you were 13. I would wait all week to watch it because they would announce next week's guests, and I would watch the tapes that I made over and over. Some other people tried to capture that anarchic spirit of Recovery. I would argue Channel V found a version of that and put it on screen. Channel 10 did less well with a show called Ground Zero, which was launched in 1997. It was a panel show that felt like it was set in a house. People walked around in the background, and one of the presenters was kids' TV show host Jade Gatt of Cheese TV fame. Except it aired Saturday nights. It wasn't for kids, it was maybe for late teens who stayed up. They had performances and interviews on a sofa. They made the mistake of inviting Friends of Rom on, and they predictably attacked the hosts. But it wasn't the same. We'd seen it all before. It became a general pop entertainment show like MTV by 1999. By 2000, the 10:30 slot and Recovery were both done. Both shows were deemed too expensive. Dylan Lewis went on to host a Channel 10 music chart show, Pepsi Live, and even later, Video Hits. He also won Celebrity Big Brother in the early 2000s. But he basically mapped out a road as a presenter and TV personality, and good on him. He's back at the ABC now, in a new version of Double J. Jane Gazzo moved to the UK and became a successful radio presenter there. She came back and worked at TV station Max for many years. Jane is now also an accomplished author. Lee and Angus, as I said, went down the filmmaking road to a lot of acclaim and success. I would love to say that after Recovery, music television was never the same. Hey Hey It's Saturday started to allow bands to perform live in the late 90s, but by then the ratings for the show had dipped and Hey Hey, after 29 years, was cancelled in November 1999. In 2000, Molly Meldrum re-emerged at Channel 10 with a new show called House of Hits. It felt like Countdown for a new millennium. The new boss was the same as the old boss. There was a studio audience for live performances, but this time it was a lineup of pop music like Mandy Moore and Aqua. It didn't last a year. Whatever this 90s Australian alternative music scene was in Australia, it was visualised by Recovery. Just watch an old clip of Recovery and look at the crowd. That's what we looked like. That's how we talked. That's who we were. That's how we rocked. When James Corden took over the Late Late Show and started mucking around with music guests and making them look relatable and fun, the first thing I thought of was Recovery. In the US, everyone saw Corden as groundbreaking. But isn't that how we want our rock stars to be? Just people sitting around in a car with us and singing? Just people hanging on the sofa for a chat? There's even a segment on Recovery where the members of UMI were riding in a car being driven around by a presenter and just having a chat and having some laughs. There's carpool karaoke right there, mate. Maybe if Howard's budget cuts didn't come in, Recovery would have survived. But it would have had to change anyway. They would have to get new hosts for the next generation and continue to do things differently. The closest example I can think of is the UK show The Big Breakfast, which was this fun, anarchic breakfast show set in a house. They regularly rotated hosts to stay relevant between 1992 and 2002. And one of those hosts was former Countdown Revolution host Mark Little. Maybe that's what the last version of Recovery was. They focused on dance music in the end. Maybe it could have evolved into something new, but it wasn't to be. Music shows came and music shows went, but nothing quite felt like it belonged to me like Recovery. I was never in the studio audience, but I felt part of it anyway. That they could tear down that wall so thoroughly through the TV was Recovery's great innovation. There was a one-hour Recovery documentary on the ABC called Recovery, The Music and the Mayhem, released in 2019. It is fun and they talk to celebrities that were on the show and the people behind it. There's some behind-the-scenes tidbits, but it's far too short and it wasn't exactly a deep dive. I could have happily watched a two-part, six-hour documentary. I'm sure there's anecdotes from every week about bands turning up late or things going wrong that I would have loved to have read about. And the ABC have taken it off iView anyway. Interestingly, the doco stops dead at 1998. There's always the odd cry to bring Recovery back, but it can never come back. It could never be recreated. It could never be the same. But what they could do is fund a new one. Recovery, with its custom sets, was probably expensive, but everyone agreed it was good. And whether it was the Lucksmiths or God, funding these shows captures our history and culture. The ABC did try with a recent show called The Set, which has technically not been cancelled. I hope it comes back. What I'm saying is, give the ABC whatever money it takes to have multiple bands perform on national TV every week again. Whatever it costs, it is totally worth it.
Welcome back to the party pad!
Party, party, party!
Party, party, party!
Hey guys!
Lee!
What's happening?
It's the end of the show!
Already?
Already.
We're gonna miss you guys.
We're gonna miss you too.
No, I'm not.
And we're gonna miss you too.
And thanks for having us in your home during the year, and we urge you to have a safe and happy new year and to look after your friends and family, and we'll see you next year.
Merry Christmas!
Don't forget to tune in.
Don't forget!
Noise.
And look after yourselves and each other.
Yeah. Bye.
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 Thanks for listening and welcome to The End Bit. This is the end of the podcast, and like every other podcast, I will talk about ways that you can support me. Look, one of the best no-cost ways of supporting the podcast is leaving me a review or even just a rating on Apple Podcasts. I've got over 250 ratings so far, and the ABC's Take 5 has 700, so I really want to chase up to Take 5. Just a rating will do, but I do read all the reviews as well. It's not just about me. The ratings and reviews really helps to drive podcast algorithms and helps this podcast come up in search results and recommendations. Another place to leave me a review is Amazon. Look, I've been thrilled with the support for the book, which came out just a few weeks ago. And if you bought one, you can go and leave a review on Amazon as well. 5 stars will be great, and again, it just helps with discovery. Another place is YouTube. I've started, slowly, putting up the first season of the podcast on YouTube. Comments and likes on that channel also helps. Those are just some of the ways to help that don't cost anything. There's also the Patreon or the tipping service Buy Me a Coffee if you want to go down that way. And there's also the new book which I mentioned that you can buy, or merch like t-shirts or tote bags. You can also follow me on social media and check out the website for show notes and playlists. All the links you need are in the description. Okay, next week, three friends start a company that stick it to the majors.
Hello, music lovers. My name's Nathan Jolly. I'm the host of Listen Carefully, a weekly podcast where every Saturday morning I talk to a different musician about their lives in and around music.
We'll have all contemporary music fans singing Yay Ha.
Search for Listen Carefully with Nathan Jolly wherever you listen to podcasts.